idea was formatted in 1966. Somewhere I had thousands of cases, hundred cases. Direct defendants, $1,000 bail. What's the problem? I said, Judge, this is a little different. These people are a little different than direct defendants. We're not concerned here with a direct defendant who takes a case across the state line improper. And I said, I think the court has got to consider this in their argument in interpreting the Bail Reform Act of 1966. I'm not convinced that Judge Stevenson was convinced, even though we finally did get these people out on bail. The point I'm making is that I think it is our duty, and I think it is in the best interest of our clients, and I think it's going to dovetail. I think the interests have to dovetail. And an acquittal, along with the treaty rights, will be the thing that these people want, need, and I think it will be one of the defenses, and it will coordinate very easily with the so-called strict criminal defense. And I think the two of them are not inconsistent whatsoever. I don't say that you say they are necessary, but I think I have sort of somewhat of a feeling that maybe that was
Can I just say this? Our clients were not caught in a bank in the middle of the night. This is not an ordinary criminal case, as the government said. Our clients took a political action for a specific reason, knowing they would probably be arrested, they would probably be tried or killed, and they did it in order that the point which they went into moved leave for would later be dramatized in the courtroom. That's why they did it. Our clients have not come to us and said, I've been caught in the bank, and you do the best to get me out. Should I cop out and get a couple of years and get me a deal, a probation or something like that? That's not where we are. Our clients did something very deliberately. And now they're coming to us and they're saying, we did this and we did it for a reason. And we ask you as our lawyers to understand our reason. And our first reason is that in 1868 a treaty was entered into by the United States government and the Sioux Nation. And that treaty, which has never been repealed, or changed, because it can only be changed by 3/4 of the male Sioux, and they never agreed to any change, says that everything from the east bank of the Missouri River to the 104th longitudinal line, which is the western division of South Dakota, belongs to the Sioux Nation, and that the federal government has no jurisdiction within that area. And because we believe in that, and because of the terror, which I described much earlier this evening, against the people in that portion of South Dakota, they took these actions. Now they're coming to us, and Russell is one of the leader from South Dakota, of the people wanting to move in need. But you will find the position that Russell presents here, you will find on the reservation presented tomorrow, when you talk to your clients, primarily, and that is, this is the reason they went in there, and this is the defense they want. And in my view, as someone who's now for 10 months gone over all the defenses, the first and foremost and strongest defense for our clients is the 1868 treaty. So I don't even see a conflict between trying to get our clients off, however we can, and doing the correct political thing, because in this case, they are one and the same. It's the defense of the 1868 treaty, number one.
I know many of the people here, friends. Smith is saying something that's very important, but I bring something to it that he doesn't have, that no one else probably in this room has. I've been down this road before. That is, I was in Bogalusa, 65, West Louisiana, Blackham. And I know what it means. I know what it means to fight for survival of people. I represent Grupp. Know what it means to fight for somebody who believes very strongly the survival of our country depends on attitudes, on ways of thinking. But we're lawyers, and our primary obligation is acquittal. Certainly the treaty, in some instances, maybe in all instances, may be a valid defense. And if it is, of course, it will be used. Defendants will be acquitted if they can be. Some of the finest lawyers in the country who are in this room. You've got people here that never get a criminal sentence. And I'm not talking about myself. There are people in this room I'd go to if I were.
Wait a minute, Joe. You're going to have defendants that can't speak very good English, number one. Defendants that know absolutely nothing about the white man's law. Come from a cultural background that believe that political dissent means just staying away from it. In other words, when the white man gives them an opportunity to vote, they show their displeasure by not voting. A whole cultural makeup that you are not familiar with, that will go along with every one of your fine languages, every one of your suggestions, because they don't know how to understand English very good, and because they have never dealt with English in the context that they're going to be dealing with now, which is their lives. In fact, the majority of your defendants, of your clients, excuse me, of your clients will not understand what you're talking about. I have a hard time. The majority of your clients will not understand what you're talking about. If you suggest one thing, they'll say, it's a white man in a white man's court. This is what they're thinking in their mind. A white man in a white man's court. He knows. Okay. Or stick. Which means good. But when I say we're fighting for a life, I mean it. Because these, the people I know, the people that were inside Wounded Knee, the people that are the defendants, the majority of them, do not know the white man's language. And it's very important for you to know this. Because honest to God, anything you suggest, they'll go along with. And you'll say, I'm representing my defendant, X, as you call it. I'm representing X, and I've got to get X an acquittal. And he'll go right along with it. You see, and maybe that's why I'm a leader, because I can understand the white man. Tongue. At any rate, been in causes before. Maybe you've represented defendants before that didn't understand the white man's language. But this misunderstanding of the white man's language is crucial to our treaty rights. It ties right in. I wish we could have a competent interpreter for each one of the defendants. Wounded Knee. But most of our interpreters speak broken English themselves, the ones we trust. So it is not as you think. You're not defending Mr. X over here because he knows the law or he's even familiar with it. He knows absolutely zero. So, I'm not asking or telling or demanding of the lawyers, what kind of law you all are supposed to represent. What I was trying to say earlier, what I'm going to say again, is, you've got to search. Like as I said, I wish I could take you in a sweat lodge. I wish I could take you down to talk to these people on the res, in their own setting, with somebody that they trust. You also have to understand that each one of these defendants, the first time they meet a white man, a strange white man. You can ask Mark. He spent, the last 10 months now on the reservation. And it took better than six for them to all of a sudden have trust into Mark. Because we have do-gooders. You see, this gets into, we've had missionaries and do-gooders, for a century or better. They all come in there for a short while and then they all leave. And nothing changes. So it goes down to the very basic distrust we have for white people. Now I hope you're trying to understand what I'm saying. And especially when you deal with a white man that's supposed to help you and the white man is dealing with the white man. They'll go along with the white man that's trying to. time and time and time again. Because we have nothing else in this world. You know, even our Indian lawyers aren't coming here because of the educational system in white America has brainwashed them. We have Indian lawyers in Boulder, Colorado. We have one here in South Dakota that has attempted to help. And we have them in different areas, Oklahoma, different areas of the country. And not one, except the one in South Dakota, has responded to what has happened to us here in South Dakota as Indian people. One, they're scared of the positions they got now. Two, they've been brainwashed that we're what the government says we are. We have no treaty rights. That we have to do treaty rights through legislation, not through law. And, you know, the treaty rights have already been legislated in my mind. So what I'm saying, if you're going to defend Mr. X, you have to realize that he can't speak very good English. And if he does speak English, he doesn't understand it. And he puts his complete trust and faith in you. And that's it. And he'll probably, 99 out of 100 instances, go along with exactly everything you suggest.
Russell, as you know, not one man here is afraid of anything. They're here because they believe in something. The question to you is this. This is what was coming from over here. You are not asking, are you, that these men would sacrifice their clan for the Indian cause?
No, I'm not suggesting.
Okay.
Let me say, I think one thing which goes through my mind. This is a very strange, abstract discussion, particularly for you people flown in all over the country. And it's a discussion which is very hard to deal with in the abstract. Tomorrow, after you've been down the reservation, you met your client, talked with that human being, there'll be people there, investigators from our committee, Russ will be there, people that those clients can relate to in terms of a longer relationship of trust. You'll, I think, understand all these problems which people are conjuring up. And if they don't go away, when you run into the real facts and the real people, and I'm firmly convinced that they will go away, that we'll have a really fine defense for these people. Why then, that's the time to talk about it. You just can't deal with these questions.
Well,
it's an abstract
proposition. Yeah, but the time to talk about fundamentals is lawyers, rather than this philosophy, which I agree with you. We've come down here, I at least have an indictment against the people that I'm supposed to be, the person I'm supposed to represent. I have a list of some 19 motions that you filed. I know nothing about what arguments were made, what decisions were made, what position the government adopted. I haven't the vaguest idea how to evaluate this case, other than what Mr. Means says, and he makes the only presentation of a defense that I can consider. Now, I think all of us should at least get started off, before we even see our clients, with the pleadings that were filed, the responses that were made, the rulings that were made, so we can have some idea of what the posture of the case is.
I thought I sent all that stuff to all
that. You sent me with motion.
Well, everything that I got, I sent you.
I got copies I don't know about the others, of 16 motions. I don't know what was done about any of them.
No, that's something about
I request that goes along with yours, Paul, I think, that certainly before I see the individual whom to represent, I would like, if possible, to have what information there is concerning the possible defenses to be raised on her behalf. I think my discussion with her would be considerably more meaningful and in line with the very important thing that Russell brings up. Yeah. and development of the trust, which has to exist, that would be most helpful. And for whatever kind of reassurance I can give some of the people, I don't think that there's one lawyer here who has not represented individuals who are in such a state of mind or a civil posture that they just almost sheep-like followed counsel, that their understanding of the law, their understanding of the position in which they were, was just non-existent. And I think that each and every one of us has proved his responsibility and his devotion to the individual, to the rights of the individual. Otherwise he wouldn't be in the position that he is, or he wouldn't be here.
Yes, but I thought we were going to do the money.
Fine. I can do that. We have a logistics problem. We're very poor, and you wouldn't believe the sacrifices that some people ended up making to work with the committee. If we had the money, the court had given us many meaningful informal property advantages, like investigators or money for attorneys, we'd have enough spinoffs so that we could Xerox. Exactly what I would have done. I would have Xeroxed every stick of paper in the case, and we would have mailed it out.
Oh, hell, listen, Joe. I'll be spending about $1,000 on this trip, and I'm not looking for you to call me as far. If you called up and said, I need $100 in order to Xerox the thing, you'd have got the $100. Instead of us coming down here, and all we know is that you filed some motions, and we don't know what anybody said about them, or what the judge said about them, and it may be that you're the best lawyer in South Dakota or in the country. But we may have some ideas. Can supplement your arguments. We may have some thoughts that might be in. For example, you take this question of having the judge recuse himself. Well, I've had experience with it, just as Jim has. I've had experience where you go in and you challenge the thought. I mean, none of us bow the knee to any judge, and none of us pull the forelock. I mean, we're in there and we'll fight like hell. But we got to have some ammunition here. Now, I'm perfectly willing to stay up late tonight. If you want to, we can sit around and at least find out what we're headed for.
That's good.
Non-reservation defendants who were charged with the arson of various buildings in Custer, South Dakota. Among them, a Texaco gas station. My preliminary feeling is that treaty rights are irrelevant to the question. Somebody burned down the gas station. Now then look at that, if you'd like to. And somebody is charged with having done so, and other somebodies are charged with having aided. From my perspective, I've dealt with cases like that before. It doesn't matter to me if that somebody is white or black or brown or red or whatever. That someone is charged with arson, and if it's bullshit, as has been suggested, it's very serious bullshit, because while I don't know the South Dakota state law, I came here prepared to hear about it. I hope that I will. I'm fairly well satisfied that the charge of arson and the aiding in the commission of arson is a reasonably serious offense. Now, if I'm participate. And by the way, I'm here not because I have to be, nor is anyone else, but because I want to be. If there's any doubt in any of your minds as to why I'm here, I'll tell you that. If I'm to participate in that, it seems to me that I have to know that I'm going to be able to participate in the way I know best. And the way I know best is to handle it my way. And to get that defendant, if it's X or Y, or who it is, more than one, acquitted of the charge of arson. And if that means that I don't consider in my judgment that it's necessary that we talk about treaty rights, then I'm not going to talk about treaty rights. And if that means, in my judgment, that the thing to do is, if the evidence is clear, and having dealt with the white man's system for some years, I know that the probable outcome is that upon conviction, that individual will go to the state penitentiary for a good long time. And in my judgment, there's a better way to handle it. That individual can get out of going to the state penitentiary for a good long time. I am less concerned with the greater cause. And if I'm here under false impressions given by someone to me or some that I created in my own head, I should know that now.
Let me just say, the Kusk is about 40 miles from here.
Yes,
right.
And
to the western half of this state.
Yes.
And under the 1868 treaty, the federal government has no jurisdiction there.
Yes, sir,
that's
but
our,
the federal
that's
government
our,
has assumed the jurisdiction, you see, and the judge will tell us. Whether or not there is jurisdiction.
That has never been determined.
I beg your pardon, sir. It's been determined in other courts, in other states. I'm not unfamiliar with Indian trials and Indian law. And if the judge says there's jurisdiction, and if the judge convicts that individual, you know, you can holler bullshit all night long, but that individual is sitting in jail while you're doing it. Now, if that does not comport with the feelings of the committee, the feelings of the people, the Indian people, then I'm of no help, and I certainly don't want to be of disservice to anyone here.
Not. Chuck, may I just say something?
Yes.
It's a pure coincidence that there's a recent Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion called United States Israel Red Feather versus Erickson, in which the Custer case that Joaquin assigned you to, and which somehow, I guess, I'm going to put the blame on Bob, secretary, or someone. It's not quite fair. I'll put it on Bob.
Yeah.
By someone else. Probably didn't intend that people involved in Custer would come out now.
That's true.
But it's an interesting illustration because the Red Feather decision, which I just mentioned, which is based on the 1867 treaty, which with the Sisseton-Wahpeton Indian Reservation, will blow your Custer case probably right straight out of state court. The 11 Indians just got out of a state jail based on an 1867 treaty. It's a complicated legal thing, and I'll run it down. I think other people here could run it down. Here's a copy of the opinion. And it shows that there is something to treaty law. Those people are free. They're out in the street on a straight treaty defense, saying the state of South Dakota have no jurisdiction over the land where they were situated, although no one ever believed that that was part of an Indian reservation, because white settlers had come in, built towns, cattle were grazing. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals said that treaty still stood, and the state of South Dakota had no business convicting Indians of crimes on their Indian reservation.
Now, that's a little bit more complicated. It's in the eastern half of the state. It's just east of the Missouri River. And there was a reservation, not much of a territory, but a reservation established by the treaty in 1867. And what the Eighth Circuit said is that although there was an act of Congress, and although there was an act of President Harrison, subsequent to the 1867 agreement, these acts which gave white persons permission to move in, establish towns, etc., did not change the lines of the reservation and did not intend to abolish the reservation. And as a result, nine of the people who were out of jail had their sentences ended, whether they were not in jail at the time, they served the time.
What are you going to do in a trial in any one of these cases if the judge says, this argument is irrelevant and I'm not going to listen to it anymore?
Well, in St. Paul, for example, the federal government has brought a motion in limine to prevent us from raising the 1868 treaty. And we've successfully defeated every such effort. And it appears clear to us now, first of all, the court has given us permission to make an opening statement about the 1868 treaty, to use in cross-examination. We believe we would be able to introduce the treaty and have the jury rule on that question. And that's basically what we think should be done in each of the Custer cases as well and all the other cases. Have a jury of 12 people, representing American people, not liberal leadership, but American people, rule on the validity of the 1868 treaty. That's basically our first line of defense. The court doesn't let us do it, they won't let us do it. But that is our effort. And so far, thus far we've been successful in the one case where we've tried it.
I didn't say that. Chuck,
yeah.
I guess you asked a tough question. And I haven't heard the answer to it. The tough question you asked is they're facing arson with a charge of 30 years in the state. Suppose they offer you criminal damage to carry the maximum 6 months. Are you going to have the right to plead? And the answer is you've got to have it in order to.
Somebody told me no.
Let me answer
that's
your question,
Chuck. You won't sacrifice the client for the purpose.
Here's the answer that I think I heard Russell say. Here's the answer that I've been operating on the basis. But the decisions, that's a question that people are troubled about. Who makes the decisions in the cases? The only answer that I've ever operated under is the client makes the decisions. And that doesn't mean that I impose my views on the client any more than the client imposes views on me that are repugnant to me. Now, if your client is offered a deal, super deal, not only is it your obligation to take it to the client, explain the options, but I think there's a further obligation, that you accept that client's answer. So when you say you have the right to plead the client, you have a right to make a recommendation based upon your analysis of the facts, upon the legal theories that are available, and the probable outcome presenting those or not.
I don't know who could have answered that you don't have the right to enter into an agreement. Obviously, if any offer is made to you, you have to communicate that to the client. I am convinced that every client in this case will give a lot of thought to it. Every client in the Woodley case and the Custer cases will want to talk with their friends, with their political leaders like Russell, and with others before making that very important decision. But you don't have the right to plead guilty, and I don't have the right not to communicate that. They have the responsibility to make that decision, and we have the absolute responsibility to let them make that decision any way they want it. I've tried cases 23 years. I've never heard of it doing any other way in any kind of case.
Well, Chuck knows that.
Yeah.
Look, I've tried it for 38 years.
So okay. So then you know. So it's not a question. So no one can say.
We understand.
So then no one can say.
But wait a minute. There's a deeper question than that. The deeper question is that if you honestly believe that this is the best thing for the client to do, and you make the recommendation, of course you can't believe it. Is it the feeling the leadership here, that they will discourage the client from pleading guilty and insist upon a full trial and insist upon the issue of the treaty issue being carried to its ultimate. That's what really comes down.
Answer that question, I think, is in each case, the defendant's going to have to decide how he wants to do it.
You're not going to tell
I'm not going to tell anybody what to do.
But I mean, if somebody went to Russell and said, what should I do? I mean, Russell's going to answer them, I'm sure. If they don't go to Russell, he's not going to answer them.
They're not going to only go to me. Yeah. You know, we have a collective, we have a central committee in the American Indian Movement.
You're not going to say to an individual defendant, hey, look, you got to sacrifice yourself for this cause. You're not going to say that, right?
Each individual, when it comes up to, if it comes up to, he was busted outside of Custer, ripping off some other place, that case has to be decided against the arson case, against, you know, what the whole goddamn thing about it, if he's connected with Custer or whatever. We went in there collectively. We're going into court collectively. As I mentioned earlier, there might be exceptions to the rule. We can't fight that. And I will never attempt to fight that. If there is somebody that wants to plead, great.
That's their business.
There's also a whole other dimension which you haven't considered, and you ought to be aware of it, and that is probably a number of people will talk to religious leaders,
yeah,
the holy people, medicine men, and will accept their advice rather than yours or mine or anything
else's.
But
they will, it will not be a matter of pressure, in other words, of sacrificing. So like, well, like Russell and Vernon and Neverland were willing to, as they said, to give their lives for this cause.
Yeah, well, I mean, no one, Russell's not sacrificing anybody else's life.
That's right. That's what the question is here, and I'm sure that that's answered now. That's, right?
Huh? What do you say? We're going to meet later on and go over some nice legal stuff?
Well, you know, I did a lot of the pre-trial motion work with help of other members of the committee. I think I'm pretty knowledgeable about not only the pre-trial motion, I've studied the facts in most of the first 19 cases. There's a big variety of them. Some of the people in the first 19 are not closely tied at all to the American Indian Movement. Some of them are very closely tied. There's a difference in the cases, and I can discuss the facts, as I said, the law. I've also done a little study of the South Dakota law. I have some legal memos. We couldn't afford to make 19 copies, but I made one set of some memos that we did for each case. And we can pass them around. You can find one lawyer in each case who can pick up on those memos.
You're in South Dakota.
You're not in Boston.
There's one down the street tomorrow. That's what.
Well, it must be someplace around.
Down the street tomorrow, this one.
There is?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we take that memo.
Mr. Prince has one, sir.
Would kind of bring this treaty issue into the most favorable focus.
Well, besides the legal case.
Is there a case, do you ask? Is there a case?
Is there of the 19 or the other group?
Probably not. That's because that's why they chose 19. But I think
we
ought to give consideration.
Talking about the others.
I don't think we should start with the 19 just because the government chose those 19.
No. I'm not addressing the question from that view.
All right. How do we escape that?
That's a lot of maneuvering.
I think we'd better get together with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Well, I'd like to suggest another case as an example of a case if we could find some way. We haven't been able to think of a way. There are a lot of other people that have allowed ideas, and maybe you all can come up with an idea to escape from the 19 to focus in on a case which would be a much more favorable case for us. There are very good cases. The cases where the grand jury made bad mistakes, obviously.
Mark, we're not talking about cases on the facts. We're talking now about a case that raises the treaty issue clearly and cleanly with, minimal.
And from the best view of the defendant.
Right.
There's a man who's got a, certainly this whole treaty issue has more than merely valid over the emotionally, politically.
Of course.
If there is such a case, don't you think it's worthwhile to devote some effort to try to get that case on the road?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's what I'm asking.
Did somebody enter their appearance in that case and fight them down to
select the case, and if it involves more than one defendant, have the lawyers who are assigned to it go up to the judge and say, look, we can arrange our schedules to get this case going February 4th, or something of that nature.
Let's get together, man.
The only question on that is, if you're going to present a treaty defense, either as a legal matter or a matter that you're going to also try and get in front of the jury, you want to do, obviously, a good job. And it takes a while to line up. If you're going to have historians as expert witnesses or experts in international law. And that's why I'm not sure a treaty case should necessarily be expedited. Not to say that all of the cases are, in some sense, not treaty cases. I'm sure that legal motions addressed to the judge based on the 1868 treaty are going to be filed across the board in every case.
presumably have been.
Yeah, but that, you know, if you do it the other way, you run the very substantial risk of waiving part of that treaty defense. Because you can rest assured that circuit's going to be looking up there to say if this was waived, this wasn't covered, a proper record wasn't made. We've all been bitten by that more than once.
And you know, if you don't make that clear right from the beginning, then what do we have to zero in on? If we don't decide that we're going ahead with the treaty, where do you go? You just go with any of these cases that you might consider criminal cases. I mean, you've got to decide that the treaty is the thing.
It seems to me like we're all in a hell of a hurry to get to trial. And the fellow that taught me criminal law at Georgetown said, to stall till all the witnesses are dead. And it would seem to me that if we've got all this goddamn legal talent together, that we have to try and find some way to get this whole proceeding stalled and restrained until after the leadership.
We're also looking at this from the view that maybe we won't be able to get it stalled. And if we have to go to trial, we damn well better be prepared to go to trial with the best thing we got to go to trial with.
Yeah, but I think we should try and key in on stopping the goddamn trials to begin with.
All right, wait a minute. Let's do some thinking.
Joe, I want to say something. You're talking about treaty rights, and I'm a woman, 43 years old, and I have two sons that went in with me. We all went in for that treaty rights, 68 treaty. And I got a shot at, but missed with a machine gun, but I broke my arm, and I haven't been able to do it since. I'm a nurse. Broke my foot. I can't even work. Right now, I ain't doing nothing. That treater writes, that's a weird one. And she knows that I've suffered, and I refuse to go to the hospital.
All right, at the risk of being overly, you know, this is really a meeting just of lawyers, let me throw out a suggestion. I'm apparently number two on the trial dock at the moment. The witness I want to call, I don't know about the rest of you, the witness I want to call is sitting right over there. And it's my understanding that his lawyer is going to tell me that he's not going to let me have him as a witness until after his trial.
That's true. That's what he would say.
I assume that's what Mr. Lane says. Well, Mr. Lane, I'm telling you, I got an absolute right under the Constitution to call him. And you can't block that right.
Has the Eighth Circuit ruled on that?
You mean the DeLuna question?
No, Schuker.
Screw it. I've got a right to call him.
I don't tell me screw it. Did the Eighth Circuit rule on it yet?
No, as far as I know. All right.
Got him in
salute. All right, but don't I have my delay?
Spelling, that's a good spelling.
Will you go check it on the volume?
Have you ever shepherdized the United States versus Eccles?
You goddamn right I have.
Okay.
Now, wait a minute. This is an Eccles case. He's not a defendant in my case.
No, but same
he's
concept.
A transaction witness, and I want him.
Same concept.
No, it's not.
Hey, wait a second. Come on, we lawyers can argue this. I just want to let you know that since Amber and I are connected.
What do you mean it's worth it?
I have
we're
no
winning.
Intention of going through this charade tomorrow.
Of what?
Going out there and getting lectures. I've learned as much as I...
Well, I'm going out.
I wasn't speaking for you, Jim.
I'm going to take you along.
No, you are like hell. I would rather do some work that would be helpful, because I'm going back on Sunday.
Well, I'd rather do it tonight.
Well, I want to work tonight. I would like to...
I'd like to do
am
it
I going
tonight.
Out
I
here
to
listen to Mark Lane give me a speech? He made one here today. It was very effective, and it was excellent. But I could be doing some work on this thing tomorrow, and I'd rather do it here.
Okay.
And I think that if there's any possibility of you bringing the clients up here so that we can interview them, it would be far better than going out there and talking to a whole crowd of people.
I want to go out there and see the place.
Who are you?
I'm Don Gregg, I'm a lawyer with the community.
Hi.
Okay. I think that probably the biggest problem that we're all going to face in dealing with these people who we represent is overcoming at least 100 years of white oppression of Indian people. I think that we have to be critically sensitive of their feelings towards us. To bring any of our clients up here, sit them in our hotel room, and say, tell me about it, is not going to work. You have to go down to where they are, to where they feel comfortable. You have to have people who are on that, what you characterize as bullshit sample. Someone said
bullshit in regards to something.
Okay, well, that schedule, which has the people that they trust, telling them, these are your lawyers, white people have fucked you over for 100 years, have fucked Indians over in this country for 300 years, we need to have people tell our clients that we are not here to fuck them over, we are here to help them as best we can. And the only place where that can happen is someplace where they're comfortable, someplace where they can relate to us, and it can't be done here.
Well, it's between my doing some law work here and listening, with all due respect to Russell Means, back on the politics of Wounded Knee, which do you think is more important?
Going down there to meet the people on their church. Going down there to listen to Mark Lane. And that's the point. They're looking forward to your coming. We talked to them last week, and you know, they're apprehensive about meeting you because they don't know how to communicate with you. And you know, they're a lot of the people we talked to said, I hope that they'll be sympathetic and patient with us, and that the court will be patient with us. I mean, they're coming from a very different place.
It's not a fucking charade, boy.
Yeah.
No, I don't. No, I
think we're kind of talking across purposes. I think that what we have to do really is go step by step. We've got to get these things straightened out first.
I think you've got to get the law passed straightened out.
Right.
First.
We're in agreement. So we can talk intelligently
to
our clients.
Let's
get started with it.
Let's get started on it. Let's get down that reservation. I think it's important to those
I mean, the agenda is open, you know, the agenda is not, the agenda is whatever you want to do tomorrow, but I do think it's important to go to the reservation.
I do.
People
I think
that
I do.
What time
I okay.
Well, but you can change that agenda any way you want in terms of what takes place when you get there, but it's important to meet the people.
Let's get
out
to
work.
Let's
get
out
of
some
of
the
dull work of
we
what you want to do.
Right here.
All right. Can we meet here? Yeah, you got a large enough room to meet in?
No, he doesn't.
As usual, Smith winds up with the only room.
For tomorrow, we got two cars.
Show
we got a table here, chairs.
All right, okay, thanks.
Joe, there's something else that I want to just say here.
This is Jay Shulman, who is the author of the article that's in your packet. He probably knows more about Missouri's election than anyone who ever existed.
Condium's all aside. I came here to achieve my work. You've got an enormous task. I want on that damn agenda. Okay? I mean, you can't just go off and try the cases. Got to hear what we're trying to do to pick juries which at least can hear these cases you want to put together. So I want on the agenda and just put them on. I'll be here all night too. But I don't
Great.
Want you to miss.
Great. We want
the,
you on the agenda.
All right, get me on. I don't give
as
a shit what time it on.
Jay, as a matter of fact, really. Logically, you can talk about jury selection right now, and I think that it will be a nice break. It will be informative. It's part of the nuts and bolts. I know you have to go back to New York. I gather you do. And if no one has strong objections, why don't we talk about jury selection?
Let's take a
5-minute break. I want some cigarettes. We will arrange it.
Cleveland, right on, brother.
Everything's going to be
you listen to Jay Shulman. Learn something about trying to pick juries.
Okay.
Lucat wanted to keep recording of this meeting. But Jim Shuttle asked me, I think, a fair question. Is that a tape recording that's going?
Yes.
Okay.
Fair answer. Yes.
I'm just not enthusiastic about having tapes of what I say floating around.
Well, what are you going to do?
I'm gun shy. I don't know.
You're going to have somebody transcribe?
No. Jay wanted to, Lou wanted to listen to it, and maybe we ought to record what Jay has to say, because that's something that could be put in an article. And when we get, when we get in our later discussion, if anybody objects to the recording going, or we think that it's a bad idea, we won't do it.
I don't think it should go during any of our discussions, only for his.
Obviously.
Okay.
Let me start by saying, despite Joe Beal's kind words, we mean the Missouri project in St. Paul, Missouri project in South Dakota. Missouri project is long now, 3 years. Look, right in the Harrisburg case, the Ellsberg case, the Camden case, and the Gainesville case is not any kind of expert assistance. We've learned a little, and that's essentially what I want to try and share. I fully understand that these people have been trying cases and prison juries for a hell of a long time, and that you have your own ideas, and some of them may be goddamn better in some aspects. What we are going to propose for these cases in South Dakota. So I'm starting with that premise. We are trying to do what these people have been doing, just more systematically than what we've been able to do in the past. And there is no who doing stuff here. There is no kind of attempt to say we have a science or we have a mystique. Not hypnotist or anything else. And Albert was talking about working with some psychologist who worked with some of your colleagues in the past and who he was very dissatisfied with. I understand that terribly well. If you don't go through these goddamn things without understanding how difficult it is, how totally humble you have to be, and that's essentially from where I'm starting. Where we start in South Dakota, as was said earlier, is essentially with a population, a real, which not only is prejudiced, but believes that Indians are less than human. This is different than what we saw in the South, or what we will see in the Attica trials in the spring, with black felons in Buffalo or Erie County. There are a hell of a lot of people who believe that blacks are human. In South Dakota, at least 60% of the population think that Indians are subhuman. That's a hell of a goddamn thing to have to try and face again. We are now finishing a survey of the judicial district. We will have interviews, and we will have codified and analyzed 526 interviews or more of people who are similar to the people who will be on your jury. The situation is worse than the survey Joe Beal was talking about. That information will be put into the reconsideration of the change of venue and the mandamus. It's much stronger than the information that was used to move the cases of Banks and Means out of South Dakota. But we still may be in South Dakota. So this FEMA moves something like this. What we are trying to make available to you, and every lawyer or every team of lawyers that try a case in this venue, is information about the types of people
who will be awful, connecting up age, occupation, religion, ethnicity, every damn important variable that you all work with anyway, intuitively or from your experience. None of you know South Dakota. That's terribly important. You all know your areas, but you don't know South Dakota. Ramsey Clark thought he knew Middle Pennsylvania because he came from Texas. Well, that was that much crap. And Paul O'Dwyer thought he knew Catholics in Central Pennsylvania. He didn't know Catholics in Central Pennsylvania either. And the Southern lawyers thought they knew white attitudes toward blacks and blacks' attitudes toward whites, and they didn't know that either. Because they work with one variable or two variables. What we're trying to do is put together age and sex and ethnicity and occupation and religion and place of residence and term of residence and trying to bring that together using the computer, which is a terribly useful instrument because it can do all of that. It can bring it together, and out of that you get, to use a damn statistical term, you get a multiple regression equation. And that tells you the strength of the relationship. It tells you whether age is a potent factor or not. Age isn't worth a damn in St. Paul. Everybody of any age can be a good or bad juror. We've got an 81-year-old woman on that jury at the moment who is the best goddamn person. And there is a clump of old people in Minnesota who are just suburb. Not anywhere else in the country have we found that phenomenon. Women are better than men, as many of you experienced, I'm sure. They're less punitive in criminal cases. But not in the South, and not in Minnesota, because men and women are about the same in Minnesota. So we can press things together. We can tell you, in effect, which type people are the best, which type people are the worst. Now, that's not good enough, because the government will see the best. They will stand out. Right, and they will zap them. That's not good enough. The worst we can see just right away by that presentation, even the minimum information voir dire, when the judge asks four questions or two questions. Judge Arno in Florida voir dire 92 people at once, and I'm sure you've all had that experience. You get bullshit out of it. Except we've got enough there to pick a damn good jury. So we start with this information as a base. It's our database. It's not good enough by any means because there are all these people in the middle. We have to work with that 40% which are not irretrievably prejudiced. And within that 40%, we have to take out the best people because not going to happen. They're going to be zapped. We have to learn how to see those people who are sleepers. And we can tell you about it. Those kinds of people, the types of people who might be okay. Now, our problem is to connect up this kind of information base with the individuals who come into that courtroom. Because if we say that Hutterites are great of a certain age, and of a certain occupation, and of a certain ethnicity, and of a certain sex, that doesn't tell us a damn thing about that Hutterite in the panel in the courtroom. It tells us he comes out or she comes out of a type that might be good. But we've got to close the gap between the type that we know about and that individual. The way we have begun to do that is in no sense scientific. It is in some sense systematic. We have learned, I think, that attitude toward authority, the presentation of attitude toward authority is the crucial thing about an individual prospective juror. How much he defers, how much kind of guts he's got or she's got. And we've learned a little bit about how to isolate that. And so we have had different groups of psychologists. None of them all that great, although some of them have world-shaking reputations, but they don't really know what the hell they're doing, frankly. They really don't. But when you get three or four of those people in the courtroom looking at those people, and when you compare their ratings, on this kind of thing, you begin to see patterns. And when you take those ratings and you press them together, you've got a number. You've got some kind of reasonably objective statement about that person's authoritarianism or that person's acquiescence. For example, there are two kinds of people on the bottom of an authoritarian line. The high authoritarians are bad. You don't want them. Never want them. Those are the people you kick out all the time in the kinds of criminal cases you can handle. But the people who have low authoritarians are of two kinds. They're the deeply bitter, alienated people, and then the loose people. And the problem, in part, is how to figure out which are the really alienated, bitter people, people you want for a hung jury. Those are the hung jury people. And then they're the loose people who have the capacity to move toward a flow in a deliberation. The people who hang never can move. They're frozen in. Now, most of you tend to move toward thinking about hung juries. And I think what you said earlier is we got to move toward acquittals, because what we've learned, in part, is that hung juries are a subset of acquitting juries. If you go for an acquittal, you can get that acquittal, but if you go for the hung, you can never get that acquittal unless there's some goddamn, you know, unusual flow going on. Okay, so there is that authoritarianism variable we've learned how to play with. Another thing we're now trying to play with, and we're trying to play with very newly in St. Paul, is body language or kinesis. People sit in different ways. And they come into the courtroom in different ways. And they hold themselves in different ways. Hold themselves in all kinds of ways. Grab that goddamn chair they're sitting on. See the tension. Well, we're playing with trying to understand the relationship between posture and stance and dominance, and what we call, or what kinesiologists call, I'm not any of these things, by the way, witness and involvement. We don't know how that's going to work, but so far in St. Paul, we've seen it begin to operate in ways that are very helpful in getting some reading of that individual and trying to link that individual to the group data we have. Now, a lot depends on the kind of voir dire that is going to be conducted. We have learned how to play with different voir dires. A minimum information voir dire is a hell of a lot different than the kind of voir dire that Judge Nichol is conducting, despite his difficulties in interrogation in St. Paul. And I got a couple of transcripts here. Right? This is 2 days of voir dire of Judge Nichol. We're going to go a month on this jury selection. That's a very different situation than Hoffman's voir dire in Chicago, or Arno's voir dire in Florida, or for that matter, Fisher's voir dire in Camden. So if we're in a minimum voir dire situation, that's the game we're playing, and we have to zero in on that. If we're on a different kind of voir dire, that's something else again. The transcript of verbal information is terribly useful if it's available. But in these cases, it may not be available. We have to assume it will not be available. And thus, we have to have people recording everything that is said by those people in the courtroom, because the words must be compared to the psychological rating. But that's sloppy. And it must be compared to what we're learning to do with body, but that's also sloppy. And then all of those things must be interrelated. And that's not enough. So what we've learned to do also is collect information on prospective jurors systematically. We collected information on 82% of the jury list. That is, we were able to permeate a 9 million population with the technique that I'm going to describe and obtain information on that many of the people on the jury list, which is absolutely crucial for the exercise of peremptory and putting all of this together. Now, the way it's done
is really not at all novel. It's really a chain letter principle. Lawyers keep files, don't you? A lot of you will keep files in your own areas of prospective jurors, people who have served on juries, and you will change them around and show them around to the inner circle and so on. We've analyzed some of the files that lawyers keep, and they're really not very good. They really aren't. And so what we do is we take, let's say for argument's sake, and keep it very simple, take 10 people within a judicial district. They must be scattered within the various levels of that social structure from which you know from the survey. The survey is a random sample of the judicial district. It is every bit as good as the wheel. It only may vary by 4 or 5% from all of the social characteristics of the wheel, so that the survey tells you what you're going to get in that wheel. You don't have to wait to get in the courtroom. You know from the survey the proportions of people who are going to show up and what kinds of people are going to show up. There will be some variance, but not a hell of a lot. Then what you do is you plug in your 10 people into that social system, and then they become the base. And they, having been properly oriented, call 3 of their friends, and that gives you 30. And the 30 call 3 of their friends, and that gives you 90. And if you have to, although we've never had to do this, not even in Los Angeles, the 90 people will generate enough information about that jury list so that we will have information on somewhere between 70% and 90%. We will have information from St. Paul on the entire 38 people who constitute our tentative jury. Now that information will be uneven, right? Don't make any mistakes about that kind of information. We have to know a lot about the people who are making the judgments, because some of that goddamn stuff will be unreliable and invalid. Right? But nonetheless, we can generate that information. And between the psychological ratings, the body language stuff, the verbal content, however much it is, and the information tree, we can then begin to make more rational decisions, and only more rational decisions, about how to use our parameters. Now, there are a lot of tactical matters which I want to take up just quickly, and I should say by word of kind of orientation. We have researched each one of these jury selections we've done. And that's been the power of what we've been able to do. We've accumulated on every one of them. From Harrisburg to Gainesville, we have interviewed the jury, the entire venire list, to the extent that we can. No one has ever done that in this country before. That's a task we undertook, and that's why we've been able to refine and calibrate. That was why Gainesville was so much goddamn better as a jury selection than Harrisburg was. We made a hell of a lot of errors in Harrisburg. Made some errors in other places. The first jury selection in Ellsberg was shitty. We didn't know a damn thing about Chicanos. We didn't know a damn thing about Japanese Americans. And those are two crucial pools in that area. And we began to learn what we needed to do. Now, you may not know this, but let me tell you, the jury list in South Dakota is now available for the February 4th trial. That's the plan here. That means we have started, in effect, collecting information on prospective jurors for the February 4th trial. That's a big advantage. We didn't get the jury list in St. Paul until the morning we started. We have that jury list here. And that gives us an advantage, small advantage, but it gives us something. Pressing for cause in this kind of system becomes crucial. Aggressivity on cause becomes absolutely essential, because we're fighting for an acquitting jury in every goddamn place in a matrix is crucial. We need every single person out for cause that we can, and that means aggressivity on the part of the lawyers. Now, it also means that we must link the survey that we've done to the questions which the judge is going to ask in voir dire. So that Judge Nickel is asking almost all of the questions that we asked on that survey. They're our questions. The questions that we asked in the name of 570 people in the judicial district. And we have an idea of what those questions mean to the people that these people come from. That's a very important linkage. So that when you prepare voir dire questions, our suggestion is that we begin to think of that as a group effort. You put in your own questions for your own particular case, if it's different like yours is. But at the same time, it's not a grab bag. You're zeroing on this particular case that you have, and it's a limited number of questions. So the judge is not in a position where he can take 20 questions, because he's going to conduct a minimum voir dire, and say, okay, I met your demands. You asked me to ask, you know, 50 or 100 questions. I asked 20 of them. What the hell are you bitching about? This kind of tactic suggests he asks only those questions you want, and that you take carefully into consideration and think through the voir dire questions that you want, and they be key to the questions that we have asked. We have asked a hell of a lot of questions about Indians and prejudice toward Indians. And we want some of those better questions in your voir dire so that we can link what we've done to what you're trying to do. Also, the plan for the exercise of peremptory challenges must be understood and internalized by every trial lawyer. There are major advantages which come from the assimilation of the plan. The judge don't, first of all, judges don't understand the plan. They don't know really what they're doing. Let me give you an example. In Gainesville, Arno said he picked juries in one day. That was what he was going to do. Actually, it took 3 days. There, they have a tendering system. Fill the box. The government goes first, and the government must get the jury satisfactory to itself before the defense moves. Well, you might say on first glance, that's bad for the defense. Very good for the defense. Excellent system for the defense. Government moves first. They have 6 perempts. You would think they would use 1 or 2 and then see the hand of the defense. Prosecution exercised 4 peremptory challenges. The first round, they were dead. They had nowhere to go. If we exercised 16, we were 2 behind their 2. We selected the jury. They never got a chance. In Camden, we were using a system in southern Jersey in which you fill the box and you move people out of the seats. It was a kind of rotation. And that at any point in time, after a seat had been filled, the judge moved for the exercise of peremptory. At any single point in the process, which was a sequential process with a rotation. That wasn't in the plan. He made it up. He talked with the chief judge. Well, there, he also gave the prosecution the right to exercise all of its peremptories at the end. They could save them. They could save them until the end and exercise them in a block. Well, there our strategy had to be, we had to stop. We could not exercise all of our peremptory challenges. We had 25, we exercised 8. We worked our asses off on that information tree and until we knew everybody behind us. And we could calculate when we got an optimum point in that jury selection. And then we stopped. We exercised 8, they exercised 1. We had 4 blacks in that jury that we wanted. One of them, super. We had an acquitting jury, and we got an acquittal on a case in which the goddamn people had been caught red-handed. And there were other factors that mitigated it, etc. But the tactic there was keyed to the game that we were playing. And we played that game. We actually sat down with the lawyers for a day until they understood, and we understood, what that system meant and what we had to do in the exercise of trust. Same was true of Morton, Stavis and Company in Gainesville. It was not true in Harrisburg with Ramsey, Clark, Houdin and Company. Because there, we didn't know enough to insist that they take the time away from their motions, take the time away from their talking about trial strategy, and so on. And so we got cowed. And so we made a lot of fucking mistakes in a situation in which the lawyers conducted the voir dire, and in a situation in which we had a pool, as we have in St. Paul, and we were able to exercise our peremptory at the end. So that's terribly important. I guess really I've said my piece. I'm saying that's the nature of the system, and there's one more thing to say and I'll stop, okay? You people have been talking a lot about your own professionalism. And I have spent a lot of time being a professional too. And I don't say this lightly or mildly. Hierarchical structures or single individuals, however bright they are, do not make error-free decisions. We need error-free jury selection decisions in these days. There's so much constraint, so much disadvantage. You need to make no errors. That's very hard. The best way to make no error decisions is to have people who can interact with one another on an equal basis, as you guys are going to do in the next couple of hours. You know that. That when you make decisions which are based upon I know what's best, even though you're a goddamn good person, it's not as good as making decisions when you have three or four people that you're willing to exchange with and share with. We have that problem with Russ Means in St. Paul and Dennis Banks. It's their case. We can't vote. We've got 10 shrinks or psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists in that team. And we've got 6 lawyers and we've got 2 defendants. It comes down to it. Those guys make the decision. They don't like what we're doing. I'm telling them. They're gonna say it. You know. We've got to work through a process with these guys where there is sufficient exchange so we can make the most rational decision. We're not going to be bothered by his rhetoric. Chooses to be rhetorical. And we're not going to be bothered by Kunstler's experience. I'll tell you frankly, I watched Kunstler pick the wraparound jury in New York. And I'll give you a couple of examples, despite the fact that I lived with Phil, and I liked him very much. But it's not a question of a personal matter. Moore and Kunstler picked couple of jurors in that case. It was a very difficult case, the burglary case. That was not the Maryland case. They put a guy on that jury, and I said, well, why'd you put that guy on the jury after he was on the jury? Well, they said, well, he reads Screw magazine. Well, what does that mean? I said, well, it means he's a homosexual, and he's an oppressed person, and he'll make a good juror. He voted to convict. Then another person. And I asked Kunstler, well, why don't you put him on the jury? I was just sitting there as a spectator watching. And they said, well, he goes to Middlebury College in Vermont. That's a good ski school, and a lot of New York Jews go there, and that means he probably lived there. Well, that's what what lawyers do a lot of the time. It's just not good enough. It's not good enough. I mean, Russell can tell you something about this fucking body, and everybody has a turn at it. Doesn't matter who's in the room, because a young woman looking at another young woman sometimes has some goddamn uncanny insights into what that young woman is. And we're perfectly prepared to take insight from anywhere we get it. So that the process needs to be as collective as possible. And that's not a put-down of professionalism. That's an affirmation of professionalism. It means that if you have working with you, because we have resource problems too, tremendous resource problems, if you have working with you a young woman, 2 young men, and they will fuck up and they will make errors, but they will have something that you can make use of. And if you treat them as equals, you will find, I think, that there will be a better product in the end. That is, in this jury selection term. I can't be there for 117 trials. Neither do you people. We have a real problem in manpower. We're going to try and solve that as best we can. We're trying to train some people now in St. Paul. They're going to be young people. But they're good and they're bright. And they have something that's worthwhile working with. But they have to be treated as equals in this process. Of course you're older, of course you're wiser. But within this process, you've got to consent to a certain amount of egalitarianism. It'll help. I'm done.
I have one thing to add to that. He said Banks and I have some problems. Banks and I decided on this one juror. She's a good-looking young woman, dressed very fancy. On a preliminary discussion of her, her interrogation went over into the next day. You know, so at the end of the day, we just had a preliminary discussion on her, and Banks and I decided that she was a lesbian. And the next day, in the interrogation, Judge Nickel asked her, he says, do you have a roommate? I said, yes, I do. And she says, well, what does she do? It's a he. That blew us off. And would you tell them about also what we're trying to do with the judge and the prosecution?
Yeah, we're trying to understand the judge a little bit.
As relationship to courtroom strategy, and once the trial begins.
Well,
another question, which I think goes into your answer. Are you using game theory in your exercise of your peremptories?
You know, Joe, it's nice to be from Harvard. But we are trying to think systematically. That means we're playing a game, and a trial is a game, as well, you know, as well you all know. But to say we're using a particular game theory, call it a zero plus game, or a zero sum game, or a zero minus one game, is just not necessary. And it doesn't add anything, it really subtracts. It's a simple process that people are prepared to work with. The big problem, Joe, is to form the jury. I don't know whether any of you people have read Murray Kempton's book on the Black Panther Trial in New York. It's a magnificent piece of work, if you haven't gone to. That son of a bitch, Kempton, understood the mystique of how to form a jury. When that black musicologist, who had that opera that he was going to have performed in Paris, and he's 50-odd years old, and when the hell is it going to happen again? When he chose to be foreperson of that jury, and he made a choice, and those editors made a choice to sit, and a political science student from Columbia made a choice to sit, that was an acquitting jury. Kempton saw that, and he understood that the defense didn't know what the hell it was doing, and the prosecution didn't know what the hell it was doing in exercising terms. Now, all we're trying to do is to say, let's try and see if we can't shake off what we're trying to do into some systematic intelligence, make it available to people, good lawyers, and we'll come up with maybe error-free decisions, maybe we'll make a couple, but we'll make as many as we would if we went into this by ourselves.
Yep. I have two questions, and I guess one of them should be best directed to you, Joe. Has there been any thinking concerning a challenge to the array of the panel?
We did a study of the grand jury based upon the jury wheel here. The jury wheel in Sioux Falls, which contained the record for this division. Where Rapid City is located. And we established that Indians were represented on that grand jury 58% of the degree that they should have been based upon population figures. We argued that this made a prima facie case of systematic exclusion, arguing Turner versus Scotia. Carter versus jury commission, and so on. And I think we have a pretty good argument on the point. The government made no showing or explanation as to why there was this disparity. The judge said, although it's not a part of the record, there's no proof of it, and I'm not sure of its relevance. question mark in my mind in the case law. He says that there were two Indians on the grand jury which actually returned the indictment. Now, there's a lot of case law which would imply that that's irrelevant. Looked at carefully, maybe there's some relevance to it. But anyway, we're going into these trials with a denial on that issue, and assuming that no attempt is made to review it prior to trial, a decent chance of reversal if there were any conviction.
Well, that's the grand jury. So
that's the grand jury. Now you're talking about
the petty jury.
We have not done anything on the petty jury, and that's something that is to be considered, something we'd like to do. We have resource problems. But,
Jay, have you done any studies on what truly constitutes a peer group in regard to jury selection? There was an interesting case coming out of the Second Circuit, the Eastern District of New York, regarding the removals from Long Island back to Brooklyn. You know what I'm referring
yep.
to?
It's very complicated. I've lived through three of these attacks on petty jury wheels, one in the South and a couple elsewhere. And now doing one, believe it or not, for Glenn Turner's lawyers. And they're complicated, they're hard, you need a lot of manpower, and the results are not usually very productive. And that might make it not very valuable here at the moment. Without the resources to do it, it's a 2 or 3 week job, and then another couple of weeks to codify and process the stuff. And that's the decision you have to make, whether the manpower is available, the outcome is probably predictable, whether you want to make the record. And that's obviously your decision, but it has to be considered within the context of the manpower problem.
As a practical matter, most of my practice is in the Second Circuit, and as you must be aware, in the Second Circuit, the judge conducts the voir dire, and some of them pride themselves on the fact that they can have a jury selected in a half an hour. And they're very reluctant to take questions from the lawyers. I think that it would be fair to assume that if they're setting aside a trial week or less for each one of these cases, these judges figure they're going to steamroller a jury in a half a day at the most.
Right. Right.
Practically speaking, or mechanically speaking, how would these people work with the lawyers to assist them in the selection of the jury?
All right. What we would then do is we would have the demography on these people. The absolute minimum that we require is the fundamental information that every goddamn judge is prepared to get. Occupation, age, religion, etc. That takes exactly 2 minutes to get it. We got no verbal information whatsoever, no attitude information.
Out here you can get the religion. I notice you're getting that in Minneapolis.
I assume you can because of the question of, we have here defendants on trial that really belong to a different religion. Need to know the religion of the. I think that might be. It's passed everywhere we've tried cases in political cases. And every judge we've gotten religion, regardless of the voir dire he's conducted. I think we can get that. So that if we get nothing more than the basic demography and the question of whether you can, the legal questions they always ask, we've got the key to what that person should be like given the social geography of the district, okay? The demography is the key to that. We also have the chance to observe that person. We observe him, observe his walk, his posture, his stance, and the few ways he faces the judge, how we can get something on a third term. We get something on body language. We get nothing on content.
Nothing on what?
Nothing on verbal content, okay? He says nothing. But we still have the demography, we still have some rating on authoritarianism, and we still have how the person walks, how he presents himself, his behavior with his body, hands, etc. We also have the information on that person, right? What we know about
what we've been told about it from the various networks we've built. That's a fair amount of information, even in an hour jury selection. Right? You've got a couple of preempts, whatever they, you've got to have 10 at least under the statute. You've got 10 to use. And so you've got your people, your two or three people sitting there behind in the well with you. Right? This is not an operation. And they've got that information right there. And it's, and then you ask for a 5 minute, a 10 minute recess as you need it, and you make those decisions with those people right there in the court. As a practical matter, it can be done that way. Yeah.
Have you done anything on the relationship among jurors?
Yes, sir.
Remember, we're not dealing with individuals. We're dealing with small group dynamics.
Yep.
All right. Have we some way of sorting out that if we have to take one juror, who do we want with him or with her?
Yep.
Okay, that's,
we do.
All right, that's one question. Second question, 100 years ago, right at the close, maybe at the beginning of the Second World War, somebody worked out something called an F-scale.
That's Dick Christie, who's working with me in St. Paul.
Right. Have you run autocorrelations on that?
Yes, sir.
Your demographic analysis?
That's what we do.
All right. Third point, have you tried a PSI ever? You know that this gadget that people say works better than a lie detector test because it detects tension. I don't know if it works. I've never seen it work. I've never tried it. I don't know anything.
The answer is no, I haven't tried it.
I wonder whether or not somewhere along the line somebody shouldn't take a shot at it. Borrow the machine and let's not listen to what they say.
Let's correlate.
Yeah, and sure. Let's see if we can run autocorrelations.
Right.
A couple of more things that I throw out. The juror that maybe is the best juror if I'm trying the case may not be the best juror if Paul Smith is trying the case.
Right.
Somehow, you've got to correlate.
Right.
Us. You've got to build us into the system.
Right.
That's another thing.
Okay.
And yet one more is building the judge in.
Right.
That is, the juror that may be a good juror in front of Judge Hoffman.
Right.
May not be a good juror in front of Judge Lasker.
Absolutely. And we've been trying to read judges, and let me tell you what we did in Camden, which I think will be very interesting. We had really 17 defendants who were pro se and 3 co-counsel. They were, many of them, priests, all of them Catholic lefty. We bargained with the judge over the use of pro se. We bargained for the jury. We negotiated with Clarkson Fisher for that jury. We said, essentially, these defendants will behave responsibly in your court, and we'll give it back to you if you remove 4 people for cause who are sitting in that fucking box. He did. No business to remove those 4 people.
There you're talking about the tactics of taking parameters.
I understand that. I'm saying we read the judge.
I don't want to read the judge to get rid of jurors. I'm saying that some jurors will...
No, I understand you, Jim.
Okay.
I really do.
All right.
Well, I was just trying to say that one of the things that we have to do collectively is read that judge and form our jury in terms of the kind of judge we have. We'll have different judges here.
Yeah.
We've got to do that. Right? I mean, I just agree with you. That's all I'm saying. I was just offering the example of how we used, how we used what we had about one judge, his weakness, to bargain with them successfully with the pro se level that we had available.
Well, what system has been set up to implement this?
The survey has been completed for the federal district. It is now in the process of being coded, and that will be done in a couple of days. It will be in the computer next week. By the time February 4th comes, there will be a set of numbers which these people can calculate, will be working with you on a little hand calculator, which gives you immediate score on the demography for these people, high, low, moderate. All right. We are now trying damnedly hard to train some people in St. Paul during this jury selection who will be available to work with you. Now, that's a hard problem, frankly. We don't have enough resources. We're going to have to do our best to generate more.
And the next couple of weeks, as we play with St. Paul and try and get ready to hear, we're going to try and generate more.
Okay.
We don't have enough
need
now.
Somebody in 2 weeks.
Pardon?
Looks like we'll need somebody in 2 weeks.
I understand that. I understand that very well, Alvin.
Yeah.
So we are, you know, if you know of any people who would like to work on this, for example, who would like to come out for a month and get trained in doing this so they can work with you back home, set them up. We'll train them, start training them in St. Paul.
Any particular background you suggest for such an individual?
Smart.
Well, we
try.
Hopefully, you know.
Smart and mature, right? That's what we really need. It's got to be good. You need two characteristics: smart, mature, and willingness to work their ass. Now, when I mean mature, you know, you have to work with you. That's hard. It's got to be somebody that you could relate to. We have a young woman, Diane Wiley, who's going to probably be working on a lot of this up here. She's 23 years old. She's bright, she's smart, she's mature, and just confident. Just goddamn confident. She's good. Send us some more 23-year-olds like Diane. Train them up in a couple of weeks, we'll be able to have a better system for these tribes. More people. Anybody else got any other questions?
Russell had asked you something. You started to answer about working the Judge Nichol in on this case. I didn't
well. Well, Judge Nichols is a very nice guy. He waffles all over the place, and he swamps us with. He talks nine times more than a prospective juror in this court here. So one of the things we did was to present him with a table and say, Judge, you're overtalking prospective juror. And he changed a little bit. And one of the things that we're also trying to do is to stimulate these movement lawyers to be more aggressive in pressing cause. Because we need those cause challenges. And they really aren't doing enough. It's another thing we're trying to do. We're also trying to figure out constantly, as Jim suggested, what particular group of jurors will be able to deal with this judge, who's not an authoritarian at all. He's too nice. How will that affect this trial? We're also trying to do something else. We've now learned that when jury selection is over, you just don't leave. You're us. But rather you say, okay, lawyers, we've got these jurors now in this box. We know a hell of a lot about these jurors. We've been working at it for a hell of a long time. Or even, you know, a day and a half. We've got something on them. How does this relate to your trial stuff? How are you going to play these people? What should you be doing? What should you be giving priority to? How should you be handling your tactics? Let's not just select them and go home. Let's talk about trial strategy in relationship to who's in that box. That's what we're also going to try to do in St. Paul.
That's a whole new ball.
Sure is.
It came off a trial where I believe the defendant was blown because of a mistake vis-a-vis the jury and the question of a particular witness.
Let me give you an example from the Gainesville trial. Alvin Force, one of the Vietnam veterans, has a face. He's been through 14 operations. Those guys got that every fucking medal but the Congressional Medal of Honor. We were presenting those guys to the jury all the time. And that was the purpose of the pro se down there. They had to argue strongly. We argued pro se. They won pro se because we fought with the lawyers about the necessity of showing these guys to that jury. Not to do anything else. Yet what happened down there that was remarkable was when Scott Camille, the fucking psychopath, cross-examined this other psychopath, the informer, his best friend who had penetrated the defense camp, who had been indicted by Guy Goodwin. The jury understood immediately that Scott Camille was a better psychopath than the other guy. They could measure the informer versus the defendant. Very powerful contrast, if you have a good defendant. Very useful. No one had any idea that would work. It worked.
so that the how you begin to use people, we put force up front. And those people looked at that suffering face for 5.5 weeks. That was powerful. We interviewed the jury afterward. They kept on talking about looking at that damn face. It was very valuable. We're going to put Russ and Dennis in the middle, two of them together on that table. Turn all the lawyers will be on both sides of them rather than lawyers on one side with their client. We want them to look at these two guys united. We want them to be together, suggest unity. Even though the theory is, and it's a conspiracy case, you don't want to show that. Right? Okay. Those are some of the things we're beginning to learn from the interviews with the jurors who come out of. You know, it's not coming out of speculation, but theory. We came back with 120 hours of tape from the Gainesville case. After the case was over, we had a lot of excellent archive.
Well, let me repeat what I said to you on the plane coming in tonight. I've heard from numerous and the most reliable and most powerful of sources that job you did at Gainesville was a masterpiece.
You make me blush.
Jay Silverman blush.
How many people in St. Paul at the defense table in the immediate area?
There are
we've got
four lawyers there usually, although Mark has been out for a while. There are two come and go. We had six lawyers who were there sometimes, with two defendants. At the moment, I'm sitting at a table right behind the defense table, my own little table. Like the jury had boxed it over there, and I'm sitting there right behind them. And it's really been interesting because I've been up to bar quite a bit. I wander around the back of the fucking well and give questions to the lawyers. Middle doesn't seem to mind at all.
And somebody with you?
We have 10 people in the courtroom. Another person. On the front bench, Jud, we have one person sitting, Dick Christie, the guy who was asked about. The other people are in the courtroom as spectators. And they're in his legal staff, but they're in the courtroom itself.
So as many as 10, right? Right there at the counsel table. How about?
The government has four if what's his face is president, the U.S. Attorney.
Clayton.
They had three today and they've had four. Most of the time.
I think they have an agent there trying to try.
Yeah. If you're asking a question about spacing, this is very interesting, I think. The government table is closest to the jury, and that has been the case in all the trials that I've worked in. And the jurors say that's very helpful to them because they watch the prosecution attorneys a lot and they don't like them. And they look somehow cheap compared to the defense attorneys. Compared to you guys, the people that, maybe not here, but at least the place of the U.S., assistant U.S. attorneys just don't look as good. And they transfer that gaze over and they do see the defense table in an interesting way. They talk a lot about the spatial relationships between the jury box, the defense table, and the prosecution table, and the number of people, and the motions that the people, the lawyers, go through. And there are a lot of surprises in this. I mean, for example, when the defense people in the Berrigan case hired Ramsey Cawthorn, and he agreed to be their one of their attorneys, the assumption was he would go over very well with the Middle American jury. They hated him. They literally hated him. Pardon?
Why?
Yeah, because he sat around and looked bored all the time. As you know, a jury trial which goes anywhere beyond a couple of days is very boring to most of the jurors. They want somebody to entertain them, to be sharp, to be up there doing things. And Clark sat there carrying his nails all the time. Except for making an opening and closing, and he didn't get up and object. He was keeping a low profile. And they didn't like that. Where Boudin, where everybody, all the defendants were afraid that Boudin was going to be, looked upon by a middle American jury as the Jew from New York, the jury loved him. The jury loved him in Los Angeles. They loved him in Los Angeles. We made a videotape, by the way, of which you might want to see sometime,
videotape of the Ellsberg jury and all the top of the case was blown by the government. 16 people, alternates and jurors, met for 6 hours and discussed the case and what they would have done, their attitudes toward the lawyers, the case, etc. And it's an extraordinary document, the 5.5-hour videotape, which is available back in New York for any reason, or can be made available to other people to see it. It's a very interesting document.
What about the body balance?
How do you mean?
Like 10 bodies here, 3 to 4 there.
Yeah. Well, the assumption is that when you have maybe 8 or 9 defense bodies and 3 or 4 or even 2 government bodies, that the government gets an advantage from being looked at as the underdog. It doesn't work that way. Seems that that almost all jurors understand that the government is a massive force, and having only 2 people there doesn't mean anything to them. They expect the defense, by and large, to have a large group of people. That's good, because then you're taking your defense seriously. It means you're in there pushing, and that's what a defense should be doing in their mind. Although I know the theory is oftentimes that you don't want to look like you're too heavy. That doesn't seem to be the case.
So the average juror, in your experience, expects a vigorous defense from counsel.
Absolutely. A vigorous defense. They dislike Nissen in Los Angeles, who did a pretty good job by all standards. Disliked him because he seemed cold and he seemed unable to relate to that case. And they want the case to be humanized. They want the case to be made something that is understandable up until the point of closing argument. Then essentially they want the most logical, concise statement of the issues so that they can deliberate in a reasonable way. Melodrama at the end turns off most jurors because they've got a task to do. And they take it very seriously. Even the lowest status juror takes it very seriously. There are very few jurors, and I've not met a single juror who has not taken it seriously. And so at the end, they like flair, but they want that flair balanced with concise, logical, vigorous presentation of the facts. And when that doesn't come, they're unhappy. I'll give you an example. Larry Turner, the young Gainesville lawyer, who did a very fine job of being exciting and melodramatic in the courtroom, a very visceral guy for a young lawyer. They disliked his closing enormously because he was just telling them melodrama. He was being rhetorical. They loved Morty Stavis because he stood there and told them what they should do, and they needed to know what to do. And he was vigorous, he was concise, and he was relevant, and he was funny to it. But he was not cheap and melodramatic as Larry Turner was.
Cheap.
He was giving away lines. He was throwing things at them. He was talking down to them. Even to the black jurors who came from the Boondocks. They mentioned him.
Jay.
Yeah.
If I may, you shot to hell one of my pet prejudices. some of what you were talking about seems to me to not conform to the Calvin studies. And
right.
I wondered, are you saying to me that they're out of date?
I'm saying.
Disagree, yeah. Or your methods are more reliable, or is that a big difference?
Well, remember, I'm saying they're out of date, one. Two, I'm saying they were simulating cases. It was simulating cases, Chuck. That's very different from what we're doing. We're playing the case from the beginning to the end. And then we're going back and researching that particular case. And that's very different. Now, I also don't think they really were looking at the kind. No one has ever tried to put together. We're using nothing that's really new. But we're trying to put it all together in a very interdisciplinary, interconnected way. And that was never done by Calvin and Zizek.
Well, he
came, you know, they came to the conclusion that if you had a black defendant, they were not very wise having tried by a black jury, for example. Right? How does that?
Well, you see, the problem with that logic, Chuck, is that there is no such thing as a black juror. There's a young black juror. There's a young Baptist juror. A young Baptist black. There's a young Baptist black who works in a steel mill. There's a young Baptist black who works in office. There's a young, and you've got to put together all of these different things. You can't just talk about a black juror. I'll illustrate. We had a black young woman in Gainesville, 23 years old, wearing a black afro, manager of a small bureau for the Southern Bell Telephone Company. The rule of thumb said the Texas lawyers and the Florida lawyers on the case was you never zap a black, particularly a young black, in the South on a criminal case. You cannot do that, it says. We zapped her. And we zapped her because we had in that jury, we thought, three black people who were low-status people. They were low-status. They came from the rural area. They were not verbal. They were bright. And we thought that if she came in there, she would become necessarily that subgroup leader. Okay? And we weren't sure of her head, her values, where she was going to go. She was upwardly mobile. In order to become a manager of a small bureau in the Southern Belt, she had to be bright, competent, and managerially oriented. Didn't like that pattern. We also had, we thought in that jury at that time, two white women, about 40 and 28, who were going to key that jury for us, the leaders in that jury. And we thought that this young black woman, who was also working for the Bell Telephone Company, also a fairly religious person and competent, would vie for leadership with those two white women. And we didn't want that dynamic in that jury, so we zapped her. When we interviewed her later, we were absolutely right about her, but we missed one more thing. She told us that she really liked nice middle-aged people. They were her hero, I mean the people who had promoted her in the Southern Bell Telephone. And she said she didn't really like young people. You know, how young people? Young white kids. And she had a lot of hostility toward those people. And she would have been very difficult for that group of people. So we zapped her essentially because of the group dynamics of that jury, as we were projecting those group dynamics. And we were right. We voted on that case. There was a one time in Florida where we actually voted, because the lawyers insisted. The defendants, fortunately, outvoted the lawyers.
Jay, I know everybody enjoyed this, and I'm not sharing this meeting.
Well, I'll be happy to start.
Work session problem that is affecting people that are older than me.
That's fine.
I think we learned a hell of a lot from what you said.
We sure did.
Everybody here.